Good morning. My name is Ben Sachs. My registration number is 11034. And together with Natalie Brown and Desi LeCroux, I represent the plaintiff, Sherry Grossman, in this case. Our appeal concerns contentions based on occurrences before trial, during trial, and after trial. The principal contention in this appeal, and this case obviously involves a medical malpractice case that relates to the surgical implantation of a spinal cord stimulator. And our primary contention on this in this case is that of the two claims, two separate and distinct claims that were raised by the plaintiff, one for negligence and one for failure to obtain informed consent, the court dismissed on a summary judgment motion the negligence claim and only tried the claim with respect to the failure to obtain informed consent. Now, the court's basis for making its summary judgment ruling was that plaintiff had not adduced sufficient evidence during the summary judgment proceeding of proximate cause, on the issue of proximate cause. And the court, in making this conclusion, misapprehended both the concept of proximate cause and the evidence that was contained in the summary judgment record. Of course, this court, in reviewing this summary judgment ruling, reviews the case de novo, and obviously forms its own conclusions based on a review of the summary judgment record. Summary judgment, of course, is a very drastic remedy. This court and the Supreme Court have so held repeatedly. If there are any reasonable inferences based on the evidence in the summary judgment record that supports the plaintiff's contention, then summary judgment is appropriately denied. And it's our contention that there were facts and reasonable inferences in the summary judgment record that should have led the trial court to deny this motion as well. Now, in this case, the court essentially found that Dr. Sisson did not cause the claimed injury, which included paralysis, neurologic injuries, impairment of bowel bladder function, and neuropathic pain. There really was not a substantial dispute that these injuries stemmed from the surgery that took place in which Dr. Sisson participated along with the surgeon, Dr. Benz.
Counsel, but didn't the experts effectively point to the surgeon as the person who would have caused any harm here?
It is true that the trial court focused on the last or the nearest cause. Specifically, he concluded that all of the evidence pointed to Dr. Benz as contacting the spinal cord. But our contention is that, you know, there can be multiple causes of in a claim of negligence, and that's also the case here. Because the court has found correctly, this court, that a party can set in motion a chain of events that in the chain of events lead to a claimed injury. And in this case, that was really the crux of the plaintiff's claim, that here we have a pain physician, Dr. Sisson, who recommended as appropriate this specific course of treatment. And
but why aren't issues related to whether his recommendation was deficient or, you know, should have included more warnings, why aren't those probably the subject of the second claim that did go to trial, the informed consent claim, as opposed to a separate and independent negligence claim relating to the surgical procedure itself?
Well, it's true that it is our contention that both of those theories of liability applied in this case, and they both properly should have gone to the jury for resolution. But we disagree with the defendant's contention that the claim only sounded as a claim for failure to obtain informed consent. And, you know, first of all, I think it's important to understand You know, and I'd like the court to remember the Hall versus Frankel case, where this court addressed the differences between a medical negligence claim and a claim for lack of informed consent. The essential elements, one is a general negligence claim, and one is in the nature of a very special kind of negligence. The informed consent claim requires evidence that the defendant doctor had a duty to advise and disclose to the patient the risks, the benefits, and the alternatives of a particular proposed treatment or procedure. And that the plaintiff, had she known, had she been properly informed, would not have chosen that procedure, and that choice would have been reasonable on her part not to have chosen.
Counsel, excuse me for interrupting. Just tell me, what evidence did you submit of medical negligence as to Dr. Sisson?
Okay. Well, Dr. Ferranti, it was yes. The expert evidence that right. was, you know, whose deposition and whose disclosure was presented to the trial court.
And he indicated that he did not think there was any negligence on the part of Dr. Sisson.
No, that's not correct. What he said is that Dr. Sisson was negligent in recommending this procedure. He would not have recommended it. I mean, there were several different aspects of the negligence theory. You know, one was that he became aware of the fact that Dr. Benz did not do a preoperative consult, history and physical, that he did not have adequate time to do that, to discharge that responsibility, and that when he became aware of that, he should have ceased the procedure. He was critical in several respects of Dr. Sisson, but it wasn't the issue of negligence that became the dispositive issue in this case. It was the issue of proximate cause. So the trial court did not criticize the plaintiff's evidence with respect to negligence. The court focused on two things. Number one, that Dr. Sisson that Dr. Benz was the sole cause. He was the person who came into contact with the spinal cord. And second, that was somehow an intervening cause that cut off the chain of causation between Dr. Sisson's negligent recommendation beforehand and the injuries that occurred during the surgery. The intervening cause analysis was clearly incorrect, because there were triable issues of fact with respect to the reasonable foreseeability of this injury. And in fact, Dr. Sisson himself personally participated in this surgery. So there were questions that were resolvable by the jury as to the reasonable foreseeability. So intervening cause was not an issue that was resolvable purely as a question of law.
What was the evidence on the reasonable foreseeability?
First of all, reasonable foreseeability, let me take a step back, because this court has said that issues of proximate cause, including intervening cause and reasonable foreseeability, are resolvable as a matter of law only in the clearest of cases, when the material facts are not in dispute. So here, the question was, were there material facts in dispute as to the reasonable foreseeability? And the court has in the Grove versus Wesson case, it's one of the most recent decisions of this court, analyzed the issue of proximate cause and has pointed out that generally speaking, whether or not a subsequent injury was reasonably foreseeable is a matter for the jury to resolve. So here, there was a negligent recommendation, our contention, and we had evidence to support it in the summary judgment proceeding, that there was a negligent recommendation for this very surgery. And then Dr. Sisson participated in that surgery.
When you say this very surgery, are you talking about the surgery itself or the selection of the type of stimulator?
Well, fair enough. I mean, Dr. Ferranti was critical of the selection of the paddle as opposed to the percutaneous, but he was also critical of the need for the surgery at all, given her reported pain symptoms. So he was critical of both. And frankly, negligence, the trial court implicitly found, at least, was an issue for the jury to resolve. The court decided this, again, on summary judgment based on the issue of proximate cause.
I guess I'm just confused that when you have a recommendation for surgery and ultimately injury is caused by a negligent surgeon, I'm not sure how the initial recommendation is necessarily medical negligence.
Well, the recommendation sets in motion the chain of events. And
so anytime a doctor recommends surgery, then if there happens to be a negligent surgeon, then it goes back to the recommending doctor?
Well, when the recommending doctor is here, admittedly participates in the surgery and retains a degree of control over the procedure, yes. So now, I see I have 4 minutes. I'd actually like to reserve 4 minutes, but I'm going to cover briefly our second issue, which has to do with errors that occurred during trial. That contention involves the fact that there was substantial evidence during trial that was presented about what took place and what didn't take place during this very surgery. And, you know, despite the trial court's pretrial and limine ruling, that evidence would not be admissible. So inadmissible evidence, at least according to the trial court, came in. And our contention is that when the defendant was allowed to present that evidence during the trial about what happened and to introduce not only evidence but expert evidence, essentially pointing the finger at Dr. Benz as being the only cause of this injury, that the plaintiff should have been afforded an opportunity to follow the defendant through that door, you know, especially after the trial court had ruled that evidence was inadmissible, and to establish what actually did take place during the surgery. At a minimum, it went to the issue of credibility.
Now, even if the trial court erred in not allowing you to rebut that evidence, how is the plaintiff harmed? I mean, how would it have made a difference?
Well, it certainly would have made a difference if both claims had been properly tried to the jury as they should have. But even if the case were confined to an informed consent claim, one of the major issues in every case is an issue of credibility. There were contentions by Dr. Sisson about who was in control of the instrumentality and what happened. And the plaintiff was denied an opportunity to present curative rebuttal evidence. That could have affected the outcome and therefore was not harmless. I have 2 minutes left. I'd like to reserve the remainder. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is David Yoon. My registration number is 23448. I represent the defendant appellee, Dr. Brad Sisson. In this case, plaintiff has raised 3 issues. Let me just cover the 3. 1, whether the trial court properly granted partial summary judgment on the negligence claim. 2, whether the trial court abused its discretion in excluding certain circumstantial evidence to suggest that Dr. Sisson had a greater role in the surgery. And 3, whether the trial court abused its discretion in denying a plaintiff's Rule 60B motion. Unless I have more time, I would like to primarily address why the trial court's summary judgment was proper and rely on my brief on the remaining issues. The trial court granted summary judgment on the negligence claim because the undisputed expert testimony was that Dr. Sisson's surgical conduct did not cause plaintiff's injury. The trial court also found that plaintiff's allegations concerning Dr. Sisson's preoperative conduct was part of the negligent failure to obtain informed consent claim. And let me explain why those 2 rulings were correct. First, the surgical conduct. As this court knows, in medical malpractice cases, expert testimony is almost always necessary to establish a prima facie case. That includes expert testimony on the controlling standard of care, deviation from standard of care, and the cause of the injury. This case involved surgery spine surgery, removal of the lamina and placement of paddle leads into someone's spine. As a result, expert testimony was definitely necessary. In this case, the trial court correctly entered summary judgment because we, in our motion for summary judgment, Dr. Sisson presented the deposition testimony of plaintiff's own experts and the surgeon himself, who all said nothing Dr. Sisson did during surgery was a cause of the paralysis. In response, plaintiff offered no expert testimony to dispute the undisputed expert testimony. As a result, the trial court properly granted summary judgment. Plaintiff is wrong to suggest that Dr. Sisson played a greater role in the surgery. Plaintiff's own expert, Dr. Ferranti, said Dr. Sisson was merely holding the suction device, that he never touched the spinal cord, paddles, or leads, and that he didn't cause plaintiff's injury. Plaintiff's other expert, Dr. Rushbaum, testified that Dr. Sisson had a very limited role during surgery, that he was not in a position to determine whether the paddle leads were placed correctly or incorrectly.
What about the preoperative recommendation for this particular type of paddle lead surgery?
Sure, that's the surgery part. First, the surgery, there's absolutely no expert testimony. The recommendation for surgery, I would submit, is an informed consent claim. But I don't think the court doesn't even have to address whether this is a negligence claim or a negligent informed consent claim, because the plaintiff's expert got to present the exact same evidence had the negligence claim existed. Before trial, the lower court said everything Dr. Sisson did or did not do before surgery was part of informed consent and relevant to informed consent. So as a result, the trial court allowed plaintiff's expert to testify that Dr. Sisson was negligent in recommending surgery for the placement of the paddle leads, and that he was negligent for failing to cut off the surgery when Dr. Sisson should have known or knew that Dr. Benz, the surgeon, did not have an informed consent claim. So those are the two allegations, and they presented that same evidence. In other words, before summary judgment, there was two claims, negligence and informed consent. Under the negligence claim, there were a number of acts or omissions. One was failure to recommend surgery and failure to cancel surgery. When the negligence claim got dismissed, all the acts or omissions just got moved to the informed consent claim and tried as an informed consent claim. So there was no harm.
As far as the preoperative acts.
Yes. So although plaintiff claims that the elements of negligence claim and informed consent claim are different, both claims require proof of negligence by expert testimony. And in this case, they present, regardless whether it was informed consent or negligent failure to obtain informed consent, the expert testimony was the same. And the jury rejected that testimony and found for Dr. Sisson.
How do we know that? Was there a separate instruction relevant to the recommendation, separate and apart from the informed consent elements?
The informed consent element has whether you were negligent in obtaining informed consent. Plaintiff's expert testified that the failure to obtain informed, negligent failure to obtain informed consent included recommending surgery for replacement of the paddle leads and failing to stop the surgery. So whether you call it a negligence claim or a negligent failure to obtain informed consent, this claim was tried and the jury rejected it. And there's no reason to believe that the verdict would have been any different if a negligence claim existed. But more importantly, I would submit to you, as Your Honor pointed out, it is in fact an informed consent claim in this context, in this case. The plaintiff is essentially claiming that she wouldn't have consented to surgery had she been properly been informed about the procedure. As this court knows, informed consent claims are premised on adequacy of information from the doctor to the patient. For a patient's informed consent to be, consent to be informed, the doctor has to inform the patient about the nature of her medical condition, the procedure that's being recommended, the benefits and risks of that procedure, and alternatives to that procedure. And in this case, Dr. Sisson's recommendation for surgery was part of that discussion. The consent form itself says this. The consent form, form that she signed stated that Dr. Sisson recommended a permanent implantation of the spinal cord stimulator after discussing the nature of the medical condition, the risks of the procedure, and the alternatives to the procedures. And more importantly, plaintiff presented expert testimony that recommending surgery was a violation or a negligent failure to obtain informed consent. In the end, plaintiff's allegations that she would not have consented if the proper discussion did not occur. And that's nothing more than informed consent claim. Plaintiff also alleges that Dr. Sisson was negligent because he didn't cancel the surgery. And that is, again, based on that because Dr. Benz, the surgeon, did not have preoperative discussion with the patient to discuss the risks of the procedure, that Dr. Sisson should have jumped in and canceled it. And that is nothing more than an informed consent claim because it's based on the inadequacy of the consent discussion before the procedure. And we would submit, therefore, that not only is it just not harmful, the ruling, but it is in fact an informed consent claim. Given that I have more time, I will, unless the court has questions regarding summary judgment, I will address the evidence that was introduced briefly. Plaintiff next argues that the trial court abused its discretion in allowing Dr. Sisson's counsel to elicit testimony about what occurred or did not occur during surgery, but declined to allow plaintiffs to present circumstantial evidence to suggest that Dr. Sisson played a greater role. This argument fails for a number of reasons. Before addressing the merits of the argument, it's important to keep in mind that this court reviews the trial court's evidentiary rulings for abuse of discretion unless the ruling is arbitrary, unreasonable or unfair. It should be upheld and evidential.
Counsel, what's your understanding of what critical information the plaintiff wanted to bring in sure. rebuttal that that would have made a difference in the outcome of this case?
It wouldn't have made a difference because the cross-examination was that the billing record, there was a billing record that Dr. Sisson submitted to the insurance company and he billed for laminectomy. And we explained that with an affidavit saying that he had to bill it as a laminectomy in order for him to get reimbursed as an assistant surgeon. And there was another reference to the operative report says we when describing some of the surgical procedure. And Dr. Benz in his deposition said, when I was referring to we, I was talking about me. And I think that was attached to the report. And then other times when I was talking about we, I was referring to the whole surgical team.
So was there any substance to that testimony aside from trying to impeach Dr. Steele?
My understanding is primarily to impeach, to suggest that he had a greater role in the surgery than what he claimed. And the problem with that is the court granted summary judgment on the surgery claim. The court said that claim is out. So the court said, you can't introduce that evidence to suggest that he's negligent when I dismissed it before trial. And that's what the court's ruling was. Why did the court allow us to present it? Because we designated Dr. Benz, who settled out before trial, as a non-party at fault. So what occurred in the surgery was relevant to the designation of non-party. But more importantly, all of this is just irrelevant and not harmful because ultimately the trial court, before it got submitted to the jury, instructed the jury over our objection that the trial court said the jury shall not consider evidence of what occurred during the surgical implantation of the spinal cord stimulation in determining negligence, if any, of either Dr. Benz or Dr. Sisson, because this court presumes that the jury follow the lower court's instruction, there is no basis to conclude that any of the evidence of what occurred or did not occur affected the verdict. And for all of these reasons, we ask the court to affirm the judgment. Unless the court has any more questions, I will end early.
Thank you.
You have slightly over 2 minutes left.
Thank you. To begin with, I think that it's important for this court to appreciate and understand that the main position of Dr. Sisson is based on a logical fallacy. The fallacy is that merely because the plaintiff is allowed to proceed on a separate and distinct theory of liability, that there's no harm in being prevented from proceeding on another separate and distinct theory of liability, negligence. The elements are not the same, and the plaintiff was denied the opportunity to present a viable theory of liability to the jury and obtain the jury's findings. So, you know, merely because the plaintiff was allowed the opportunity to go forward on one special negligence claim does not eliminate the error in this case. Second, I think that the court should not be putting blinders on. When substantial evidence is erroneously admitted into a case and the plaintiff repeatedly attempts to introduce curative rebuttal evidence and is denied the opportunity, it's not sufficient to just give a jury a limiting instruction telling them to disregard days and days worth of testimony and evidence that was erroneously admitted.
How does that substantial evidence relate to the actual issue that was being tried, though?
Well, I'll just point to one important respect. You know, the question has to do with what was Dr. Sisson's role during the surgery? And, you know, the attempt was made by Dr. Sisson to minimize his role during the surgery. But in fact, plaintiff wished to point out that his role was significant and considerable. So in one respect, it was the plaintiff's contention that Dr. Sisson directed Dr. Benz to pass the laminectomy lead after encountering resistance. So he basically gave a recommendation about how to proceed with this very delicate procedure. I'm sorry, it looks like I've just run, and now it's...
This is what the effect that I attempted to describe.
That wasn't just an issue of credibility. It was also a fundamental issue to be tried in the case for the jury to decide.
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. That's okay. I want to thank both counsel for their excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.